national news from a grassroots perspective, you're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. Today on Groundwire.
Each candidate's page also has a Google News feed, which has a list of recent articles about the candidate.
In Mexico, they see that there's people in London, Paris, Montreal, aware of the situation in Mexico and actually taking pictures and saying that they're against it.
So Walking with Our Sisters is an art installation, but it's more than that. It's a memorial.
Hello, and welcome to Groundwire. This is Filza Navid.
And I'm Brenna Owen.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This week, Groundwire was produced at CFRC Radio in Kingston, Ontario, on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territories.
Coming up, we will hear from the co-founder of OpenKingston.ca, a website in Kingston modeled on Open Democracy, Manitoba, and Winnipeg Election.ca.
We'll also hear about a demonstration that took place outside the Mexican consulate in downtown Montreal. Demonstrators called attention to the 43 disappeared students in Mexico.
Finally, Groundwire will feature Walking with Our Sisters, an art installation that honors the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
We'll also hear a community radio report from the NCRA about how its equity committee has grown into an equity reading group, which will meet next on November 25th. That's all coming up on this edition of Groundwire. But first, here are the headlines.
Anti-pipeline protesters took to social media last week to post their best hashtag GMFace following Kinder Morgan's court case to remove protesters from their Trans Mountain Pipeline Project site on Burnaby Mountain near Vancouver. The lawyer stated that the protesters' angry snarls are not just intimidation, but actually assault. On October 30th, Kinder Morgan filed a civil lawsuit against SFU professors Stephen Collis and others. Stephen Collis spoke to CJSF about the action, which he calls a slap or strategic lawsuit against public participation. Mayor Derek Corrigan stands behind protesters, and both the City of Burnaby and the Tsleil-Waututh Nation are challenging the legality of the National Energy Board's approval of the project. Court resumes November 17th for defendants named in the Kinder Morgan suit. Thank you to Megan Thomas, JPG, and Stephen Collis at CJSF at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC. Listen to full audio at Wild Salmon Warrior Radio on SoundCloud.
I received documents from Kinder Morgan's lawyers. It was about a 4-inch thick stack of approximately 1,000 pages of materials announcing that they were going to try to get an injunction against people on the mountain in the park and get us out of there, and that they would were also filing a civil suit for damages. But people are telling me it's about a $5.6 million suit that they're claiming against myself, four other named defendants, including another SFU professor, Dr. Lynn Cornby from biology, and several other people. They filed them both at once, which is very, I think, fairly unprecedented, but they filed both these cases at once. What's being heard first is the injunction, because Kinder Morgan are claiming urgency on that score. The injunction would apply to the five named defendants, and it says any John or Jane Doe. So literally they're asking any human being to be prevented from going to certain areas of the park where they want to work, and they're calling that trespass. So we're trespassing on their land, even though it's a park and it's also unceded Coast Salish territory. They're claiming the area they need to work in, which is inside the park and inside the conservation area, land owned by the City of Burnaby and land over which the Tsleil-Waututh Nation has title. They're claiming that they have proprietary rights while they work on it, and that if we go there, we're trespassing. If they get the injunction, we'd be in contempt of court and we'd be arrested.
Okay.
Anybody would be. This is anybody would
right,
be.
Right, if you're in the way.
It could be a landmark situation here, right? In North America, really around the world, activists are rallying around this, and the support we're getting is extraordinary. Just extraordinary.
Yeah, there's been some online campaign for legal defense funds, and
Yeah, and someone set this up. You know, we didn't ask for it. Someone offered to build a funding site, and we've raised $30,000 now in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty incredible. I mean, the legal fees are going to be crazy. They're going to be astronomical, because, of course, Kinder Morgan has the best lawyers money can buy, as they say. So it's been a quick struggle. It's been very expensive. Takes a toll. But people are, you know, galvanized by this. People do not want these pipelines. They do not want Canada to keep pushing this old system of fossil fuels. They want to change to renewable energy. They're getting the message that's everywhere on this planet right now, and everyone is speaking this talk increasingly. Even, you know, institutions like the IMF, which is not exactly a radical institution, instructing governments just to start disinvesting from fossil fuels. We have to do this. So people realize that and see this as a fight that they want to get behind. It's called a low threshold kind of decision. The plaintiff doesn't have to prove a lot to prove that they need the injunction. So the onus is on our lawyers to prove why this would not be a fair right thing. And part of it has to do with jurisdiction, right? I mean, everything that Kinder Morgan are claiming is based on the National Energy Board. And that is an undecided authority at this point. And there are several constitutional challenges against the authority of the National Energy Board.
Next up, CKUT's Aaron Lakoff brings us an update on the fight against austerity measures in the province of Quebec.
On October 31st, an estimated 50,000 people took to the streets of Montreal to protest against austerity measures planned by the Quebec Liberal government of Philippe Couillard. The demonstration, which was organized by labor unions, student associations, and community groups, brought in participants from across Quebec. Protesters wound their way through downtown Montreal, demanding an end to cuts to education, daycare centers, and health care, while at the same time asking for $10 billion more dollars to be reinvested into public services. In a large-scale act of civil disobedience, protesters defied Montreal's controversial P6 bylaw by refusing to share their route with police and also by encouraging march participants to wear masks. P6 has been used by police to criminalize protests and to make thousands of arrests in the last 2 years in Montreal, but is also now the subject of a constitutional challenge and a civil lawsuit. 80,000 students went on a one-day strike on October 31st so they could participate in the demonstration. Student unions in Quebec are already mobilizing for springtime 2015, when there's talk of launching another student strike on the issue of fighting austerity. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT in Montreal.
That's all for today's headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. We'll move on now to today's feature stories. With Ontario's municipal elections in full swing in October 2014, CFRC Radio conducted an interview with the founder of OpenKingston.ca, an initiative that aims to improve democracy, citizen journalism, and empower citizens, increasing voter turnout. OpenKingston.ca also hopes to raise awareness of the broader Canadian and international open democracy movement. Andrew McCann, the creator of Open Kingston, speaks about why this initiative is needed in democratic dialogue.
There are a few really good online citizen journalism and online journalism sources emerging in Kingston, the Kingstonist. There's one for Kingston East. There's another one... I'm not thinking of right now. And then there's the new station, Station 14. Of course, there's you guys have an increasing online presence. So there's already a lot of online journalism for a small town. So the question is there a particular role for Open Kingston to play outside of the election context? It'd be great if there was and if there's interest and engagement, and we'll just see how that evolves. But right now, we turn into a pumpkin on August 27th, and the important thing is to try to engage citizens and increase voter turnout and access to information between now and then. I mean, it's a huge problem, right? Like, if you think about it, not very many people read the local newspaper. Not very many people actually can make it out to a candidate's debate or an all-candidates debate, maybe a few thousand at most. Not very many people watch the debates on local TV. So you're essentially talking about a real lack of information. I'd say we have less information available at the local political level than at the provincial and especially at the federal level in Canada, even though these are our councillors in our city making very fundamental decisions about the infrastructure and also the services for our municipality.
So are you the sole operator for Open Kingston, or are there other volunteers that are involved?
No, we're a group of volunteers. There's some community volunteers. There was also one programmer who we've paid basically, you know, several hundred dollars, less than $1,000. So he's really volunteering at this point as well, thankfully. So we're seeking donations as well as more volunteers. Again, as I said earlier, we're modeling this effort on the winnipegelection.ca site, and that site taught us a few things. One was the amount of traffic that we might expect. So they said basically the first time they did this in 2010, they had about 1,000 unique page visitors prior to the couple of days before the election, and then they had like 43,000 unique visitors the day before and the day of the election. So people trying to figure out how they were going to vote and using the website as a hub to connect to different candidates' websites and to news articles. That's something else I should mention. Each candidate's page also has a Google News feed, which has a list of recent articles about the candidate. And then there's also some other news articles linked to in relation to the particular issues for the questions we're asking. Something else we learned from winnipegelection.ca, not just about their traffic numbers, but we also learned that they tried to operate some forums the first time they did this in 2010. There's an election this year and just a few days before ours in Winnipeg, so they're operational again right now. So we've been corresponding with them from the beginning in August, and they have found that it was impossible to manage forums because it required too much moderation. We haven't had any forum action yet. We just launched the website last week, so we'll see what that what happens with the forums. We'd love it to be a space for democratic dialogue, and hopefully citizens who get on there and check it out and start conversing about the topics will use it in a respectful way.
Have you received any kind of initial feedback from maybe some of the political candidates or just some friends and family that you've talked to about Open Kingston? Has there been positive reaction, any kind of positive reaction or feedback from people so far?
Well, there's been several hundred, going on 500 unique visitors so far to the site just in about a week's time since we started tracking it. There's also been very positive feedback from anybody who's checked out the site who I'm aware of. But I think we're hesitating to promote it too much before we start to get the candidate responses to the questionnaires, because that's really a big part of the value of the site. And we've just really pinning down our last couple questions right now. So we'll, you know, starting next week, we'll really, and this weekend perhaps, we'll really push the promotion. We've already had a really good response. I mean, if Winnipeg, a town of over 700,000 people, has 45,000 people, most of whom are coming the couple days before the election, they said as of August when we were talking to them, they'd had 3,500 unique visitors. I mean, Kingston's, you know, only 150,000 people. So if we get a few thousand leading up to the election and then maybe 20,000 or something like that, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 the few days before the election, I think we'll be really happy with the outreach. I mean, only 36% of Kingstonians eligible to vote voted in the 2010 municipal election. And so, hey, if we see that go up to 38%, 39%, maybe we can take part of the credit for that.
Last Wednesday, a dozen people showed up to demonstrate outside the Mexican consulate in downtown Montreal. The protest came after activists interrupted the consulate's Altar of the Dead event on Saturday, November 1st. Wednesday's demonstration was less pronounced in attendance, but just as pronounced in the hearts of those who came to stand up to the violence surrounding the 43 disappeared students in Mexico. CKUT's Leila Lemgalef brings us what some activists had to say.
Mexico's Day of the Dead celebrates the life of the deceased, but has recently been lashed out at in light of the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico. In a follow-up event in Montreal, peaceful protesters spoke out against the crime itself as much as the crime of silence surrounding it.
My name is Jean-Yves Taranger.
And what brings you here on this November 5th outside of the Mexican consulate in Montreal?
Oh, I come here because I want to protest against the mass killings that have been occurring in Mexico, and where there's no justice, nobody's persecuting the people responsible for it, and now they kill students. So, just for protesting for an augmentation in the prices of the school, so it's like an extreme case. Yeah.
And are you of Mexican origin or?
Yeah, I'm from Mexico City.
What are you hoping to see concretely?
I think that if you give a global pressure, so if in Mexico they see that there's people in London, Paris, Montreal, like aware of the situation in Mexico and actually taking pictures and saying that they're against it, it's like in the media, it shows up and it makes a kind of pressure on the politicians to make them aware that we know what is happening and that we think that is unjust.
Yes, my name is Anita, Anita Marin. I can't stop thinking that, you know, it could be any child. It's not just, you know, those 43 kids that disappear. Gee, these kids are 18, 19 years old, you know. I don't know if you saw the pictures, but there's one of them. They remove their skin in his face and they remove his eyes. A child of 18, 19 years old, you know. I can't picture that. What are we talking about? It's a student, you know. It's a student, it's a child, basically, you know. So that's why I'm here, because I would like to you know, to do something to provoke a reaction, to not let these things happen. And if we don't move from our houses, if we don't do anything, they will keep happening. And yeah, you know, today we don't move because it happened there. Tomorrow, no, because it happened there. But the day that it's going to happen to us, then what? You know, then we're going to do, but it's going to be too late. It already touched that. So that's why we have to be more conscious.
Edgar Hernandez. I came to show my disaccord with the Mexican government and with the situation that Mexicans are living back there, because I find that it's not something new, the thing that the government is involved with kidnapping and arresting and being colluded with the narco. But this time it's gone too far. The killing of the 43 students, the Ayotzinapa, it's like the tip of the iceberg. And so for me, the only way that I can show it's by coming here and tell the representatives of the Mexican government that I don't agree with what is going in Mexico, and if I want to show that I'm to hope that there's going to be a change in that situation.
So why do you think that this is something that's important to do in Montreal as a Mexican and even as a non-Mexican?
Well, as a Mexican, since my roots are there, I feel compelled to show to come and support the Mexican society in the effort to say to the government that it's been enough. But as a person, I just see that this is going too far, that a government, whoever nation it is, they have to be responsible of the actions that are, and the situation that people of their country live in. And I don't think that any government will accept that to their people, and why Mexico, and that's something I've been questioning a lot and since. But unfortunately, that's the situation, and because of thousands of reasons. So as a human being, I came here to protest also against the violence and that is happening there.
For the CKUT News Collective in Montreal, I'm Leila Lemgalef.
For Groundwire's final feature story of today's episode, Ophira Horwitz brings us a story about the Walking With Our Sisters art exhibition. First, here is a musical introduction.
Hello to everyone listening. We are Spirit Flowers. We're an Indigenous women's drum group in the Ottawa area. We just formed a couple months ago, so we're very, very excited to come to you today on the radio, of all things.
So the first song we'd like to sing for you is called Anishinaabe Kwe. It's an Ojibwe song that is a song meant to honor women. It's calling women up to dance and celebrate their clans. So it's a song to remember to honor women and that they're part of their lives and for them to celebrate their culture and their livelihoods. And so here it is.
Anishinaabe Kwe, heed me. Walking With Our Sisters is a traveling art installation that honors the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The installation comprises of almost 2,000 moccasin vamps decorated by volunteers from across North America. This week, a community conversation will take place in Ottawa to consult with members of the community and see how people would like to get involved. You're listening to Spirit Flowers, a local women's hand drum group that will be performing at the event. I spoke with Christy Valcour, the Métis artist who started Walking With Our Sisters. How is Walking With Our Sisters different than what we usually think of as an art exhibition?
So Walking With Our Sisters is an art installation, but it's more than that. It's a memorial. We say that it's a memorial because there's a lot of ceremony and community organization involved in it, and the main goal of it is to honor the lives of our missing and murdered Indigenous sisters. And so the installation itself is typically put on at a gallery, but sometimes it's being put on in museums or community halls. What a person would see when they walk in there is they would see the floor covered entirely in red cloth. And on top of that red cloth, there are moccasin vamps. Now, vamps are the tops of moccasins. Sometimes they're called uppers. And they're the part that is typically adorned with beadwork or quillwork or some other kind of decoration on the top. So the vamps are intentionally not sewn into the moccasins to represent the unfinished lives of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. Inside, when you walk in there, what you would see is all of the pairs of vamps that we have in total. We have 1,810 pairs right now that were made from people all across the country, and 333 of those came from the United States, and a dozen or so came from overseas.
It's almost a shame that this is radio, because I wish our listeners could see pictures of the memorial. Could you please describe it to us?
So when a person comes in, what they'll see is the red carpet on the floor, and they'll be able to walk along that red carpet. They have to take off their shoes. Visitors are invited to come in and smudge sometimes by the volunteers if they want to. There's tobacco that's offered, which a person can carry with them. Now, tobacco is one of our sacred medicines, and so we offer that to people if they want. It's optional. They can take that and walk around with it, and whatever prayers they put into that tobacco is then put into another box at the end of the walk through, and then that's typically put onto a sacred fire or brought out into the bush somewhere by one of the elders.
What do you think people will take away from experiencing this memorial?
Well, we have three main goals with the memorial. The first goal is to just do something very simple, which is honoring. So we honor through ceremony and through traditional ceremony. And that's the first goal. And by everyone who attends, they are participants in that honoring. To, you know, just come together for the moment and in a solidarity to say that all lives matter. And the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women matter. The second goal that we have is to provide a space, a safe space and a comforting space for the families. And also not just their families, but their friends and the wide circles of people that they've left behind and affected in their life. And then the third goal is that we create a space where people who are not too familiar with the issue can come and somehow leave a little bit more familiar with the issue. You know, when they take their shoes off and they have to walk around in their socks on this cloth, it's very moving. Everybody that comes in is really respectful and they're quiet. And they're just paying their respects. And then when they leave, I think by participating in a way where they're actually walking through something and walking on something and walking alongside those mocks and vamps, it affects people in really profound ways. And maybe part of what this is doing is giving people the language and vocabulary to talk about it with others.
What's kind of neat is that Walking with Our Sisters brings together communities in more ways than just the memorial itself. Like there's been beating nights and movie nights. Could you please talk a bit about the event that's coming up in Ottawa next week?
So the first community conversation that's going to be held in Ottawa will be an introductory format that will show a little bit of video. The people who have been working on the committee in the background to get ready for it will just be there to answer questions, and the community can come and find out what Walking with Our Sisters is and you know, why it's so incredible. There'll be lots of pictures of the vamps being shown, and people can just see how, if at all, they want to get involved and volunteer.
This is Ophira Horowitz reporting from Ottawa for Groundwire.
The National Campus and Community Radio Association is hosting the second edition of their Equity Reading Group later this month. The National Campus and Community Radio Association, or NCRA, is made up of campus and community licensed radio stations across Canada, joined together to help network and support each other in meeting broadcast regulations. Each month, a member of the NCRA hosts the reading group and proposes a selection of equity-related readings. The group meets online to talk about the readings, and the discussion is broadcast live by the host station and then uploaded to the internet for all to enjoy. Last month, the Equity Reading Group was hosted by Zoe Ludinsky from CJMP in Powell River, British Columbia. The subject of the reading group was non-defensive communication. This month, the Equity Reading Group will be hosted by Robin Erickson, Victoria King, and Michael Welsh from CKUW in Winnipeg. This reading group will be about positive space.
In today's community radio report, we'll hear what the NCRA has done to promote equity in the organization and in campus and community stations across the country. We'll then hear details on how you can participate and tune in to this month's Equity Reading Group.
What kind of work has the NCRA done or set out to do to promote equity within the organization?
The NCRA Equity Committee has been around for quite a long time, and prior to me being on the board a few years ago, I can't really comment on the work that the Equity Committee did. But the last thing that the Equity Committee undertook was quite a large study of the sector of campus and community broadcasting, and how many people of color were at various stations, and what the experience of people of color at those stations was. And so we got a bunch of information back from the people that we surveyed, both with a SurveyMonkey survey and some in-person over the telephone interviews as well. That recognized that people of color didn't feel like they were fairly represented, and that there was a fair amount of racism that existed within the organizational culture, I guess. And so after this study was done, the Equity Committee didn't really have a direction on how to tackle this very lofty work that needed to be done. And it was recommended from someone that maybe we look at having an equity reading group to start looking at different documents and some material to help just expand the knowledge base of what equity means, and to provide access maybe to a larger group of people to participate. Because part of the difficulty with the Equity Committee and with committees just in general, I think, is participation. You know, there's a lot of people who said, oh, you know, we're really interested in this issue. We're really interested in seeing this work progress. And we're really interested in breaking down these barriers for participation. But people weren't coming forward to sit on the committee and do the work. So we're hoping with the Equity Reading Group that it touches a lot more people in the community and, you know, helps just change ideas about diversity and make space for broader diversity within our campus community stations, but also at the national level, at the board level, and through committees and executives at the NCRA. My name is Robin Erickson, and I'm the program director at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And we are proudly hosting the upcoming Equity Reading Group for the NCRA, National Campus and Community Radio Association, on Tuesday, November the 25th, between 10 and 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. We hope you can tune in and join us for this very important discussion.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire from CFRC in Kingston, Ontario. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Brenna Owen, and I was joined today by Filza Navid. I'd like to thank the following contributors: Robin Erickson, Megan Thomas, Audrey Obraham, Ophira Horvitz, Layla Lemgalef, Aaron Lakoff, and Filza Navid for making this edition of Groundwire possible. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.